from Relay. This is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode 107, recorded November the 19th, 2025. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and I am joined this time by Alan Sepinwall, longtime TV critic, now of What's Alan Watching, now and forever of What's Alan Watching at whatsalanwatching.com. Alan, welcome to Downstream. Thank you so much for being here.
Jason, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's so you were most recently at Rolling Stone, and that ended, but you had very good timing, been spinning up your own site again at What's Alan Watching. So why don't we start there? Just what can people find over at What's Alan Watching? I want you to plug it now because I'm a subscriber and I think people should definitely check it out. So what's over there?
Thank you for letting me do the plug early.
Yes,
a lot of time on these shows, the plug comes at the very end,
after which
people have already stopped. So I'll do it real quick so you folks can get to what we're going to talk about. At whatsalanwatching.com, I review new shows. I do lots of recaps. At the moment, I'm recapping Pluribus and The Chair Company. In the new year, when we come to it, I'll be doing Shrinking and Scrubs and some other things. Scrubs, you know, a show I once upon a time recapped at the original What's Alan Watching website. So time is a flat circle. So it's a mix of that. There's some free content. Most of it is paid. And then there's a second paid tier where I do, you know, weird bonus stuff. Like, you know, I did a recent thing about if people, actors whose careers paralleled in some way, swapped signature roles. So, for instance, if Kerry Russell was on Homeland and Claire Danes was on The Americans.
Right.
I do things like that, and I have a Discord and other stuff. So it's a lot of fun. If you care about TV enough to be listening to a podcast like this, I think you would really enjoy what I'm up to over there.
I agree. So you mentioned recaps and reviews, and I wanted to start there because I started reading your stuff. I think the one that I really got into is, and I was thinking about this yesterday, because in hindsight it doesn't make sense, and yet it makes perfect sense, is you wrote about How I Met Your Mother, which on the surface, it's a sitcom. I have this on the Incomparable, the pop culture podcast I do. We have a whole thing about, like, well, you know, the danger of doing covering comedies sometimes is, what do you say other than like, oh, that was a funny joke? And yet you were able to find a way. And I think this guides my thoughts about the difference between a recap and a review is, you know, you were reviewing those episodes and talking about the plot and talking about what worked and what didn't. And you know, I don't know if you can really recap a sitcom because it is jokes and some plot elements, but it was a review. So I guess I wanted to start there. Like, how do you approach anything from the standpoint of, presumably, you know, everybody's seen it, so they're not, it's not like a Television Without Pity recap like back in the day. It is a review, so you approach it from that perspective, the critical perspective of what worked and what didn't in this episode.
Yeah, and when I use the word recap, that's more me sort of conceding that I lost a particular linguistic battle,
because
back
you.
In the day I would always call them reviews. But it's just that people have decided that when you're talking about an episode that has already aired, that is a recap, whether or not there is literal plot recap going on in there. Right now, you know, right before I jumped on with you, I was working on my take on this week's Pluribus, and there was definitely some of me recounting what happens in the plot, but it's me doing that in order to then analyze what's happening, why it's happening. And sometimes when I do it, it's me specifically talking about what's working and what isn't in a particular show, or sometimes it's me talking about what this means thematically, what it means to a particular character. So why is Carol Sturka doing what she's doing in this particular scene? And the only way for me to do that is to first, you know, recount what it is that happened. But I'm always trying to analyze in some way. And you're right that recapping comedies is harder. And I'm not doing nearly as many of them now as I used to. I'm not recapping as many shows in general as I did, you know, 20 years ago. But I'm definitely more judicious about doing comedies because, as you say, a lot of it just comes down to this was funny, this wasn't funny. How I Met Your Mother was a good one, though, because it was a quasi-serialized show. It experimented a lot with form. There were always these hints about who the mother was, what was going to happen. And then ultimately that all fell apart in a spectacular fashion. And that was just a case where it's like, because I'd been writing about it every single week for 8 seasons, I felt like really qualified to step in and elucidate all of the ways in which they had messed up with that finale. And could I have done that if it was just a show I wrote about once a year? Yes. But I feel like I was really weighing in and getting into the weeds about what the show was doing well, what it wasn't, and how it was gradually losing its way. So that by the time they did that finale, we shouldn't have been surprised that it was that much of a catastrophe. And yet we were, because how could they possibly have thought that that was a good idea?
Yeah, we live in hope. But I also wonder if there's some element of, you took it this far, you got to take it to the end, right? Like, you know, you put in the work. Now it's almost that you can see the end in sight. You have to, you have to get to the end, even though you know what the end is going to be.
Yeah, there's a sunk cost fallacy going on. And there's also a phenomenon that my wife used to refer to as hope watching, which is kind of the opposite of hate watching, where it's like, this could be better, please be better. And the sad fact is, it almost never is. Like the Parks and Recreation situation, where the show like takes a half a season to figure out exactly what it is, that is so rare.
Yeah.
Usually if a show is, you know, mediocre or too bad at the start, it's going to stay that way. But at the same time, when you watch a show on and on and on, it becomes a little bit like Stockholm Syndrome, where even if it's not very good, just the sheer amount of time you spent on it makes you invested to some degree in the characters. And I've tried to be more ruthless in recent years of saying, you know what, I just don't care about this anymore. Yeah. I should stop. I'm not enjoying this anymore. I should stop. And sometimes I can do that and sometimes I can't.
So what makes it worth it, since you have to choose, and it is a huge commitment when you do, how do you choose what you're going to recap? And I'm going to say recap, but I don't agree either. It's a review. But yes, I know it. We all know what we mean.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Language is fluid and evolves. Yes. And, you know, okay. It's different now that I'm on my own versus when I was at Rolling Stone. Because when I was at Rolling Stone, which is a really great place, and I love the editors there, there was still like a sense of who the Rolling Stone audience was and how many people would read a particular thing. And therefore, like, you know, if there's some really random, obscure show you love, with a few exceptions like Reservation Dogs, there was a sense of, this is not really worth your time and effort to be doing this for us because we're not going to get enough eyeballs on it.
Right.
And you could be writing some other things, which I understood, and so I didn't. Now that I'm on my own, I'm following my muse here, and I'm just saying, I care about this show. I want to write about it. I'm going to do that. And we'll see. And it's still early days. I've only been doing it full time for a couple months now, and we'll see what happens going forward. But I think back to like when I was at HitFix. And do you remember Brockmire with Hank Azaria?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Watch the whole thing.
Yeah. So that's like an IFC comedy. So right there, like it's an out of the way channel that people are not looking for stuff at. But I really, really liked it. And I said, all right, I'm going to recap this. And I would see on the social media site formerly known as Twitter, people would say, I wasn't going to check this out, but when I saw you were writing about every episode, I thought, well, if he cares that much, I should do it. And so there's a certain degree of like, you know, putting on the seal of approval through a recapping versus just writing a review and saying this is good. It's this extra level. And so we'll see if I start doing that with some things. I don't know. Right now I'm trying to juggle what I'm excited to do versus what I think might convert people to want to pay to subscribe to read it.
It's a balance. I mean, I having gone out on my own, I went out on my own 11 years ago now. I will say, it is, not only is it kind of freeing to make those decisions, and it's still a business decision. You know, if you decide to go in a corner and write about things that literally nobody cares about, it's very hard to build a subscription business on that. But at the same time, I think being true to yourself and what you're enthusiastic about within maybe a limited realm, but the limits are pretty broad, I think it's a recipe for success, and I think you're already on your way. So I think you've got good instincts, and being true to them, I think, will benefit you. That's my wisdom of 11 years of being on my own in my garage.
I appreciate that. I just remember, like, there would be times when I was at HitFix/UpRocks where I was recapping, say, The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Which was a show that once upon a time I thought was good. I never loved it, but there were times when it was really good and I had no problem writing about it weekly. And then at a certain point, I was just doing it because it was one of the most popular shows on TV, and therefore it would drive traffic to the site. And I just, you could tell if you go back and you look at those, that these are being written by somebody with nothing new to say about the show, who doesn't necessarily hate it. And eventually I did hate it, and that was the point at which I was able to convince my editors to let me stop. But before that, it's a show written by someone who doesn't really care, who's just over it. And nobody wants that. And there's no value to the reader from that. There was a time back in the blogger days when I wrote about every episode of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip,
yep.
which I hated. I absolutely yep. hated, but I enjoyed pointing out all of the ways that I hated it. And I think there was some value in that. But these days, there's almost no show that I dislike that I would want to, you know, make that weekly commitment to.
Well, I mean, you choosing to make a weekly commitment at this point is, I mean, it does help. I think it helped raise Brockmire's level of visibility. I think it definitely did that with Reservation Dogs, too. I mean, you can't do that for every little show that you want to support, but it does help when you do. I wanted to segue into talking about TV criticism in general, but you talk about the hate watch and things like that. I will just say I know multiple people who used to write recaps for Television Without Pity, and there is some real truth in that, right? Which is this show is too popular to stop covering, but yeah. nobody likes it. And I wonder, just talking about meta criticism in general, I remember I was growing up, I was a big, as a teenager and a college student, a big Peter Gabriel fan. And I remember reading a record review of one of his later After So albums. And it was a critic who said, well, Peter Gabriel's not that good and he's still not good. And I was like, who is helped by this review, right? Like people who don't like Peter Gabriel are not reading a review of Peter. You want to put it in the context of like, hey, how does this fit? And I that's how I feel about some of TV criticisms, like, you know, kicking a shit, like, you don't like it, we don't like it, why are we even bothering? You know, how do you feel about, I mean, obviously you said like Walking Dead, you're like, please get me out of here. Obviously the goal, talking to Tim Goodman when he was at the Hollywood Reporter during peak TV at its peak,
yeah.
he said we can't review everything. Curation, finding gems, telling people yeah. that there are good things to watch, that should be our job. Do you think that's basically where we are?
Yeah, that is absolutely the way I've approached it. And every now and then, and I'll be curious to see if that happens here, every now and then it would be a case of, here's this super high profile thing that people are hyped for, and I don't think it's good. I should write that just to sort of yeah. warn people away and save their time. But mostly it's like Tim said, you should be pointing people to the stuff that they want to watch. You know, I think most of the Taylor Sheridan shows are at best mediocre. But there's no point in me continuing to write about that at this point. What are you getting out of it? If you like Taylor Sheridan, you like Taylor Sheridan. I don't. And so
right.
me, you know, and I wrote something about Landman at Rolling Stone. And, you know, that is a really popular and complete garbage kind of show. I never need to write about it again because it is what it is.
It would be more interesting if you were to say, hey, I think this is the best, whatever show this would be, the best thing Taylor Sheridan has done. And you might want to,
yes.
that would be in it. That's a real, man bites dog thing, but it could happen.
And no, absolutely. Yeah. Some of his movies are really good. And I've heard from some people that I think the Sam Elliott Western one, 1883, is not bad. That I haven't really watched much. But I just think about all the time over the last, 10, 15 years of when we were in peak TV, I'd be watching an episode of something and, I'd get through the first, maybe into the second. And I would say, you know what? I just don't care. Yeah. I don't like this. And I would go to my editor and say, I'm just hitting the eject button now. I'm moving on to something else. And more often than not, my editors would sort of understand, if you're not into it, like, you shouldn't be writing about it.
Yeah.
So
Tim Goodman called that the 2-episode test.
Yes.
It's like, after 2, I may just be out. And sometimes a pilot can really get you excited, and then you watch episode 2 and you're like, no, it's just not going to happen. But at some point you have to just kind of cut bait and move on. I want to say, I think that is a healthy way to view things, to say that if something is very high profile and everybody is talking about it and you think that it isn't very good, I think chiming in to a certain point is valuable, because you're like, oh, I've heard all the hype, but Alan Sepinwall says it's actually not that great.
Yes.
And I do this too, right? Where it's like, if it's a major product, because I'm a tech reviewer, right? If it's a major product and I think it's not very good, I will say so. If it's like a scrappy little app or something from one guy and he tried and it's just
yeah.
bad, I'm not going to kick that guy. Like, why would I? What's the point? It's, I mean, and some people will because it's kind of mean and fun, but like, yeah, nobody gets any value out of an app you've never heard of isn't very good. Who cares? Right.
Yeah. And also, and there's like certain genres. So, you know, I'm not huge into romance. I'm not huge into YA, that kind of thing. And so if I don't like a show in that genre, I'm just going to leave, ignore it because, you know, it's dog bites man. But on the other hand, if something really sticks out to me and I say, oh, this is great, and this rose above my historical lack of interest in this kind of show, then that's worth doing.
Yeah. And your readers may be like you, right? I mean, if you're in the genre, this always happened with me and Tim, where I'm into sci-fi stuff and he didn't really care that much. And then a sci-fi thing would break through for him. And it's like, well, you don't need to tell me about it because I'm going to watch it. But you can tell your audience of people who normally don't care, no, this one's worth your attention. That has value, too.
Yes.
So one of the things, when I was not on my own, right, I was the editor at Macworld. We got to cover literally everything about Apple. And then I went out on my own and I realized very quickly, I am but one human being. And that means I have to choose. So I was curious, how do you, as a single person, right? Like Tim, for a while, had Dan Feinberg and they at THR, they would tag team it. You are on your own at What's Alan Watching Now. So how are you approaching what you can cover? Because, I mean, even now, it's not quite peak TV anymore. But, like, there's more television than you could conceivably watch, let alone review. So what's your process of picking and choosing?
I mean, a lot of it comes down to the bona fides of something, like who is creating it, sometimes who is starring in it, sometimes what channel or streamer is it on? And, you know, and that's usually my starting point, you know, or in certain cases, if I hear, ooh, this premise sounds cool, I want to watch that. Mm. Although often if it's an exciting premise, but it's not from like exciting creators, it's, you know, it's not going to work for me. But like that is where I begin. And so I'm much more likely to review, for instance, something on FX because they've got a really good track record there. I'm much less likely, as I said, to review something from Taylor Sheridan because, you know, I don't want to yuck anybody's yum at this point with that. But sometimes it's literally just people will recommend stuff to me. You know, I published today a review of Blue Lights, which is a cop show on BritBox. Which literally what happened was another TV critic was texting with me and said, hey, have you seen Blue Lights? I think you might like it. And then an hour after they said that to me, a publicist pitched me on the new season of Blue Lights. And I'm like, okay, the cosmos is clearly trying to tell me something. I will take a look. And I watched it and I liked it and I wound up reviewing it. So it's a mix of various things. There's so much TV out there that weirdly, more often than not, the gems are pointed out to me by my readers than me unearthing them on my own. But, you know, if one person points this out to me and then I can tell, you know, thousands of other people about it,
right,
then I think that math works out.
Right. That makes sense. It's funny. I was going to mention your Blue Lights review, which I read this morning, because it reminded me, it's an odd path to take. Thank you for telling me how it happened, because I was going to say that that's a thing that I noticed with Tim Goodman in his post-THR life, is that he has been kind of wandering around and exploring kind of international stuff. This is an interesting place and time for TV where there's like Netflix has got a lot of stuff that's being produced, you know, in other countries, and there's Acorn and there's BritBox, and American viewers have access to TV that we never even had access to before. It just increases the flood of content that is hard to get, you know, get through. So I, you know, seeing you review Blue Lights, I was like, oh, this is interesting. It's like, again, it's kind of like The Wire, but not really like The Wire.
Yes.
And it's in Northern Ireland, and that's really interesting. So, you know, do you sort of lay back and hope that people hip you to what is worth checking out on international, or are you watching what, you know, what screeners Acorn is sending over, or how do you approach that?
It really varies. And I'm wary of writing about international, not because there's not good stuff there, but because I feel like I don't have the same footing. About 10 years ago, Matt Zollersites and I published something called TV the Book, where we ranked the 100 best shows of all time. And we specifically decided it would be the 100 best American shows of all time. And the reason we did that was we're like, okay, we know Monty Python, we know Fawlty Towers, we know Prime Suspect, we know like some British shows, but we certainly do not know all the British shows. And, you know, like if you talk about some things just from England alone, the people who are actually from there are like, oh, no, that's not the best. That's just what went over the pond
right.
to PBS. And so, like, you don't want to be stepping in there. And so in the case of Blue Lights, I have another critic friend who loves, I forget if it's Line of Duty or Line of Fire. I think it's Line of Duty.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's constantly evangelizing to me about it.
Jed Mercurio, I think.
Yes, the guy who does, exactly. And I keep meaning to do it, but it's a lot of episodes. And one of the selling points of Blue Lights is it was only 3 seasons of 6 episodes each. So I could get through that pretty quickly. And so it's like, maybe Line of Duty is much better than Blue Lights. And so if I come in here talking about this other show, are people going to say, well, why haven't you written about Line of Duty? Why haven't you written about that? So that's one aspect that always sort of gives me pause, and I need to get over that. The other thing is, you know, subtitles are tough for me. Like, it's just, I'm highly distractible. And so with a show that, like, you really need to be looking at it at all times, you know, it's like it takes me twice as long because I constantly realize I'm missing stuff and I need to go back. And so as a result, I kind of gravitate more towards things in English, or in certain cases, like with Squid Game, most of the time I will watch the dub version. And I know that makes me sound like a Philistine, which is, again, one of the reasons I try to avoid doing it, because I feel like I'm not
right.
getting the proper experience.
Yep, I get it. I get it. I had I had somebody recommend a show to me that made me laugh because it was a Canadian cop show called 19-2. And
yes.
I watched the pilot and I was like, oh, this is like an American cop show. It's super generic. But it was notable only to me because it was Jared Kiso from Letterkenny as the lead, and his partner is Admiral April from Strange New Worlds. So I was like, okay,
yes.
Canada, right? But I was like, that's okay. I don't need to. There are so many American procedurals I don't watch.
Yes. It's so funny you mentioned that one, because literally on the Discord for What's Alan Watching, if you're the top tier subscriber, people will suggest shows to me, and someone just mentioned that one a few days ago, and I'm like, oh, it's Jared Kiso, and I put it in my queue on wherever it's streaming right now.
Yeah.
But I haven't gotten to it yet, but it sounds, at least from what you're saying, like maybe I should, you know, be moving it further down the line.
It feels very, very CBS procedural to me. I mean, it's just not, it doesn't do it for me. But it was funny to see Jared Kiso being something else. Because I really do like Letterkenny and Shorzy. And it was very funny to see this kind of Canadian production. Perfectly competent. I think that if somebody just gobbles up police procedurals, they might like it just fine. I'm not that person, so it's fine. It's just fine. My Canadian tastes run more toward those classic sci-fi channel mid-budget sci-fi series.
That's
more my, you know, or Travelers, that kind of thing, right? That's more my style.
Sure.
Although the X-Files back in the day was basically that until it became a hit.
Yeah.
Let me take a break and tell you about our sponsor. This episode of Downstream is brought to you by Factor. Fall always feels like a bit of a reset. Well, that's true. I'm just looking at my weather forecast. It's just everything is different now. I think kids are going back to school. Everybody's getting back into busier routines. The days are shorter. And finding time to cook can be tough. That's one of the reasons people love to turn to Factor, which has chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals that make it easy to stay on track and enjoy something comforting, delicious. Doesn't matter how hectic the season gets, because it takes no time to get your meal ready for you with Factor. You can enjoy more variety and more meals. Choose from a wider selection of weekly meal options. There are so many choices, including some premium seafood choices like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. The salmon is my mom's go-to favorite because we get her Factor because she doesn't really want to cook for herself anymore. And so we get her Factor, and I feel a lot better about what she's eating. Factor can support your wellness goals. They've got GLP-1 friendly meals. They've got new Mediterranean diet options packed with protein and good for you fats. There are global flavors if you want to try those. They've got some Asian inspired meals with bold flavors influenced by China, Thailand, and more. More choices, better nutrition. 95% of customers say Factor helped them live a healthier life. You'll feel the difference no matter your routine, and that's because of the choice. Because you have so many different choices, you can find the choices that fit whatever you want out of your meals. We get Factor meals here from time to time. Factor is very nice to send them to me occasionally because I read a podcast ad like this one. And again, my wife just steals them and takes them to work with her because she works in a library, and you know, she's got to have a lunch every day. and they passed her test, which I say this a lot in this ad, but I'm going to say it again. A lot of this podcast stuff, she's like, okay, whatever, and tries it and then forget it. Like, that's it. Like, I'm not going to do this again. You use your little podcast thing. Forget about it. And Factor passed the test. Bottom line, Factor passed the test. She took the meals. I have to fight to make sure that I've got at least one or two that I can try so I can talk about the quality of Factor meals on here. And it reached the point where we got it for my mom so that she could have it too. You can eat smart too by going to factormeals.com/downstream50off and use the code downstream50off to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for 1 year. That's code downstream50off at factormeals.com to get 50% off plus free breakfast for 1 year. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer only valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase. Thank you, Factor, for feeding my mom and sometimes my wife and me, and for supporting Downstream and all of Relay. So talking about how TV has changed, and we're talking about peak TV, more past tense now, which is really interesting. Where do you think scripted television is right now and where it's going? I know that, you know, this is the year I feel like we're going to look back on and say this is the year where The Pitt happened and hit it big. And that's interesting because it's a more network TV like show on streaming. Is that a trendsetter here? Sort of like where do we go from coming off the highs of peak TV right now?
I mean, I hope The Pitt's a trendsetter. It's one of, like, my two favorite shows of this year. It's that and Pluribus. And, you know, I got to make a top 10 list at some point, and I'm not sure how I'm going to choose between them. I think one of the things that happened as part of peak TV was you had all of these streamers desperate for content at the same time that you had movie studios, like, really just completely pulling the plug on the whole mid-budget drama for adults genre.
Yeah.
And so you had lots and lots of screenwriters who suddenly could not sell anything as a movie. And so they went to television and they sold these things as series that should not have been series. And these people did not know how to make television. And so you would have this phrase that still, you know, gives me hives of, this is a 10-hour movie. Oh, or this God. Is an 8-hour movie.
Thank and you for championing how terrible that is.
It's so bad. And it's like, I like serialized TV. I'm writing a book about The Wire right now. You know, I've written books about Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and The Sopranos. There ain't nothing wrong with serialized TV. It's when it's only serialized and you don't care about what is in the contents of a particular episode and you don't have any sense of TV structure and what makes TV different from movies other than the fact that it's longer. That drives me crazy. And so, and on top of that, the other thing that we've seen that's aggravating me is seasons have gotten shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
And so suddenly you have The Pitt. They made 15 episodes and it's mostly a serialized show, but there's usually at least a couple of patients per hour where their case is resolved within the course of that hour. And it's a show made by people who made their bones in network TV, many of them writing for ER.
Yep.
Just as Pluribus is run by a guy who started out his career in the aforementioned The X-Files. And so you've got sort of the best of both worlds in a way, which is you have the bigger ambition, the higher budgets often, although The Pitt is also made that way because it's done cheaper. But you have like expansions in filmmaking technique that was not available when ER or X-Files were necessarily being made in the 90s. But these shows are made by people who know how to make television. And in the case of The Pitt, they're able to make lots of additional episodes. And so you really get to know the characters. And so by the time in like episode 12, where Mel says, you know, I want to donate my own blood, please, Dr. Robbie, let me do this. Like you're really invested in Mel because you've spent a lot of time with her that you would not necessarily feel if this was episode 5 of a 6-episode season. So that's great. And I've definitely read some trade articles suggesting that HBO and HBO Max are now telling, you know, people writing scripts for them, this is the model. We want to do more of this. And to me, that is very, very welcome.
I think it is good news. Also, and I know this is, we've covered this since episode 1 here on Downstream, this idea of do you do a weekly drop? Do you do a binge drop? And the strengths and weaknesses of both. But I'll tell you, it's not just having 15 hours with those characters. It's also having 3 months with those characters.
Yes.
That makes a difference because you kind of live with them. And like once it's done, people can binge and have been, I think, binging The Pit afterward. That's fine if you want to do it that way. But like it really felt good to check in with our friends in The Pit every week.
Yes.
It matters. It makes a difference to, narratively to, you know, to sit on an episode for a week, especially as for you, as somebody who is writing these reviews of episodes. But I feel it too as a viewer. Like, I like to sit, even when something binge drops, I like to not watch them in a binge. I like to like spread them out a little bit and savor them because I think that it works. And I spent, we all spent 3.5 months with The Pit in earlier this year. It was a really nice experience.
I agree. And selfishly, like you said, I can recap The Pit. I'm going to do that for the second season. And so that's good because that's a show people are excited about and they can read me doing it. What's Alan watching? But like just as a viewer, too, you're absolutely right. Like it's I remember when Mad Men was on, for instance, and like that was a show that is a my favorite thing to ever write about just on a weekly basis. But B, like, that was a show that people just wanted to kind of marinate in and think about and not move on directly to the next episode and the next episode and the next episode. And we haven't entirely lost that because not everyone's doing binge releases. And even some of the outlets that used to do it are pulling back. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if at some point even Netflix is already starting to mix things up. Like Stranger Things, the final season is going to be released in three chunks.
Yeah, they're batch releasing it now.
Yes, which is definitely more manageable for both TV critics, but also, you know, primarily for viewers. And I do feel like at some point in the next few years, Netflix is going to have some show that they say, all right, we're going to do this weekly. Mm.
Really? Mad Men more fun for you than The Sopranos?
Well, the thing is, The Sopranos, I was not writing about weekly when it was on until I think the last season.
Oh, okay.
The last two seasons. And so I went back to do it, and I just wasn't as good at like the craft at that point.
All right,
as
it was early because you've now written a book about it, and you were at the New Jersey Star Ledger, the official newspaper of The Sopranos.
Exactly. So. But like in those days, you know, it wasn't like I would write periodically. Like I would come into the newsroom on Monday and say, "Oh, they killed Ralphie. I need to write something about this." But
news.
I wasn't doing it every episode.
All right. Okay.
And yeah. So
Mad Men, you were there week to week.
And I also think there's just something. It would be Mad Men and The Leftovers as the two that I wouldn't even necessarily say those are my two favorite shows of all time. Just the episodes of those shows gave me so much like thematic richness and formal playfulness that I had more to say about them than I would about your average episode of, say, Breaking Bad.
I get that. There's a richness to it. And Tim and I talked about the existential crises of Mad Men. Like, there's a lot in there to unpack, and that makes it fun to write about. It makes sense to me. Talk about The Pit and about episode or season lengths. I was thinking about The Diplomat, which I like, but it's very West Wing-like, and it's becoming much more West Wing-like now in the third season than it was in the first season. But I was struck by how I think that show is hurt by season length. The second season especially was I think it was shorter. I think it was like 6 episodes or something like that. And that feels like a show, having watched the third season, which I enjoyed, and it's a bit of a ride, but I get that same, and I spread it out. I didn't watch it all at once. I spread it out. But I feel like that's a show that wants to be more like The Pit in its narrative momentum, or would benefit from being a little bit more like that. And instead, they just sort of get up to speed and then they're done. I don't know what you think about The Diplomat, but that strikes me as being a little bit of a counterpoint, where it's sort of like it's network, adult network in a way, but not quite as, I mean, not well executed, but like the format, I think, hurts it that they're only getting 6 or 8 episodes and then they're done.
No, I absolutely agree. And that second season I wrote at the time, like it was palpable that it was 2 episodes shorter.
Yeah.
You know,
I feel like they must have had a production issue with whether it was with COVID or strikes or moving. I think they shot the beginning in the UK and then they decided that they were going to move the sets to the US. And I mean, I'm sure there are production issues, but production issues aren't an excuse for the fact that second season like felt like it wasn't done. Right.
Yes. I mean, you look at something like in the second season, it opens up. They'd done a cliffhanger at the end of the first season where like 4 different characters are right near a car bomb as the car bomb goes off. And you're like, well, who's going to die? And of course, the one who dies is the least important of those four. Yeah. You know, it's what, you know, what writers call schmuck bait, where if you think they're actually going to kill off Carrie Russell's husband, you're a schmuck. But and the thing is, that could have been really effective if that other character had been given like more to do in the first season.
Right.
But even with 8 episodes, it's so plot heavy that you can't really marinate with who the supporting players are in the way that you could on a network procedural show or just your network show in general. Like on The West Wing, I feel like I had a good sense of who a lot of the lower tier assistants were in the White House. Like they all had some degree of personality, you know, even if they never got stories of their own, just because they were around so much. And so if one of them had been killed in a similar way, it would have hit harder. And so that's just not a thing that happens now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I wanted to ask you about something that Julie Alexander and I talked about a lot on here, which is streaming has been very successful at offering bingeable sitcoms, and people love them and they watch them. But mm-hmm. streaming has also been really bad at creating original sitcoms. And a lot of the sitcoms that hit are just network sitcoms with lots and lots of episodes. Do you have any thoughts about what is the future of like, where do we get our comedies from? Because like if Netflix and all the other streamers really love importing network sitcoms, like there needs to be a network with a budget for sitcoms to create them to get them onto yes. streaming. And it seems like a real conundrum now where like the classical, you know, if you can get a good 22 episode or 13 episode even sitcom on a network, there's a good chance that 5 years later it'll be a hit on Netflix. But how do you yes. do that?
I mean, you know, there's still Abbott Elementary right now. There's yep. still Ghosts, which I don't watch, but which I know a lot of people really yep,
like.
So
it.
there are some. But yes, you're right. And I think that gets back to the episodes thing, because Girls 5 Eva, which I know has some like had some real devotees when it was on Netflix and then on Peacock or vice versa. I've lost track.
Yeah, Peacock and then Netflix. Yeah.
Peacock and then Netflix. Yes. Okay. And the thing about a Tina Fey show is, and I know she didn't create it, but she produced it. So the thing about a show by Tina Fey or by one of her acolytes is they take a while to sort of figure themselves out, even over the course of a season. And all, you know, if you look at any season of 30 Rock, it's always stronger by the time you get to the middle and especially the end than it is at the beginning. And these were shows where Girls 5 Ever or some of these other things, where the season is the length of the beginning of a 30 Rock yeah. season. So it's a lot of these comedies take a while to sort themselves out. The number of sitcoms that were recognizably their great selves from the very beginning is really small. It's like Cheers, Arrested Development, Modern Family, although that kind of lost steam eventually. But like Modern Family, the beginning is the version of Modern Family that everybody loved. There's not a lot of those. And so when you're doing 6-episode seasons, even 8 or 10-episode seasons of comedies, you know, they're just sort of starting to get up to steam right when the season ends.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And I think that, as much as anything else, is what sort of kept people from falling for it. But at the same time, you look at, like you say, the big comedy hits on all the streamers are the old network stuff, with which have dozens upon dozens, if not hundreds of episodes. And you would think that the streamers would look at that and say, that's what the audience wants. And the only explanation I can think of for why they're not doing that is because it's just too expensive. And so their thinking is, we can make enough money off of the ones where we're only paying for the streaming rights to without having to produce them ourselves. But at a certain point, you're going to run out of it.
Yeah, I just wonder about the economy of it. Like, at some point, if you're a broadcast network, is your sitcom strategy sort of like, we're really looking, you know, we're willing to spend a little bit of money on this, even though we're cutting way back on scripted, because if we get a hit, we can sell it to Netflix, or we can put it on Peacock or whatever, and we can make a lot of yeah. money. Does the financial calculation become more about, while the streamers are really desperate for network sitcoms, let's make some network sitcoms? And if I was Netflix, if I'm not willing to fund on Netflix a 15-episode sitcom season, and then another one, and then another one, and then not cancel it after 3 seasons, but keep it going, maybe, you know, do I do I consider doing kind of like a production deal with a network to produce some sitcoms that I will get eventually? I don't know. I just find it really funny because you're right. They are going to run out. And it's a format that really works on streaming, but that streamers can't seem to originate. And I'm glad A Man on the Inside is coming back. I'm glad Mike Schur is making a comedy for Netflix. I enjoy it. It's season one was really sweet and fun. But I also sort of feel like, but wait, shouldn't Mike Schur be making 20 episodes on NBC?
Yes. And it's hard. There's just much less of that. And the other thing is I'm really fascinated by what's going to happen. Like, is the younger audience interested in this kind of thing? My kids are, but they've grown up with me as their parent. And so I'm like putting Cheers and Twilight Zone and all these older shows in front of them. And, you know, and also more recent stuff like Parks and Rec and Community. So, like, this is what they love. But, you know, are people who are primarily watching YouTube and TikTok and Reels and things like that, do they even care about narrative? I don't know.
I don't know.
I mean, the fact that you have things like the Suits phenomenon, which began with people showing, like, segments of episodes on TikTok, mm-hmm. suggests that there is that audience. But I'm not sure.
Well, my kids are... my daughter is mid-20s. I cannot believe that. My son is 21. And they have both gotten into narrative. My son, Better Call Saul, was the thing that did it for him. And my daughter has always loved binging sitcoms, The Office, Parks and Rec. And so I think there's hope. But again, they're not the teen generation. So there's always that worry that the next generation down is going to be less and less attached to it. I'd like to believe that they'll just find it in a different way, but there's still kind of content there. Anyway, I think it's so funny that it's so obvious that sitcoms play incredibly well on streaming, and yet nobody seems to know where they're going to come from.
it's
great.
Look, if I understood anything about how this business worked, I would not be running an independent TV criticism website right now.
That's fair. That's fair. I feel the same way about the tech industry. So do you have any thoughts? So normally on Downstream, we do a lot of business slanted stuff here. So we're talking about, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery up for sale and David Ellison taking over Paramount and the mega trend that you probably... I'm interested if you have any thoughts about any of this stuff, but maybe the biggest one is the mega trend of network TV in America becoming pretty much just a vehicle for sports and reality and almost no scripted anymore. And obviously, your primary focus is writing about scripted television. So, you know, what do you have any thoughts about sort of like that side of it, the kind of the business side of where television is as a business right now?
It's weird because you would think at this point, the majority of people who still have, like, who have not cut the cord and therefore are watching broadcast television are older. I mean, that's the same thing on cable. So, like, if you watch cable TV, there's a lot of pocket catheter ads and things like that, you know, reverse mortgages.
Tom Selleck.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And
people who can recognize who Tom Selleck is are probably worth considering a reverse mortgage. It's nice to know.
Yeah.
Speaking as a guy who actually has a Magnum PI podcast. Anyway.
And so you would think like, and the older audience is the one that grew up on scripted and grew up watching Magnum PI and things like that. And therefore, you would think that they would want to be doing more of it, but it's also expensive.
It's expensive.
And the audience is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so I don't know. I mean, to a degree, it's surprising that all of the broadcast networks still exist. I guess the CW really doesn't at this point. Like, it's just barely a thing. And it's certainly not what it was a few years ago before Nexstar bought it. But at a certain point, you would think that Fox or one of them would just fold. Like, NBC would just be a tab on Peacock and there would not actually be an NBC broadcasting network anymore. That hasn't happened yet. It's going to at some point, but you're right. Like, the only thing that's bringing eyeballs to them is sports and other, like, big event live programming. And sports is now starting to move to streaming. Like, you know, I have to have like six different subscriptions just to watch the Knicks play.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That is the streaming fracture. Although there is a little bit of a trend toward broadcast, some sports going back to broadcast, just because it that not only is there room now on networks for it, kind of like how NBC is going to put the NBA on multiple days a week, right? That is a pretty dramatic shift, but now that it gets them on cable and they can still stream it. And I don't know. It's very strange. If Warner Brothers Discovery gets bought out by Paramount, I mean, you know, you're going to end out, or Netflix or whoever, it's one fewer streamer, which I guess yay on one level, but it's also one fewer place for content to be created, which I don't know.
That's bad.
Yeah.
That merger, I'm really hoping does not happen, because that would just be really catastrophic for the amount of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And the amount of opportunity to go against the grain and not just do franchise IP.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So here's a personal question for you, which is, you've got this process. You've got a not infinite, but an enormous amount of stuff that you can watch. Plus, you get, you know, you're getting screeners, so you're getting people saying, you know, here's our new thing. You just like the first seven episodes of Pluribus are here for you, stuff like that. So you've got a huge selection of things to choose from. And as I said before, you're only one man. What delights you when you crack open those screeners or start watching something? What are the things that make you lean forward and go, oh, okay, that, like, because you've seen it all at this point, what are the things that make you delighted that, like, this is interesting, this is something that I want to write about or that I want to watch more of?
Well, and it's a thing you have to be careful about. I've been doing this almost 30 years now, and you have to be careful about overweighting surprise above all else, because the average viewer does not watch nearly as much television as I do.
Right.
And so you can't just be like, oh, this is a show that's doing something I haven't seen before, therefore it's awesome.
I remember Roger Ebert talking about how he had to be very careful, having seen so many movies, of like not overweighting that a movie was novel.
that's exactly it. And it's so, like, if this is, like with Blue Lights, it's not really reinventing the wheel, although the fact that it's set in Belfast is somewhat novel. But for the most part, like, it could be an ABC network procedural. There are certain elements in common with that. But it's executed at a very high level, and so therefore, that's what made me engaged with it. I mean, certainly the thing, I do like surprise. I will still never forget, there was one day I was in a former office and my desk was a mess, and I needed to clean it. And when I got to clean my desk, I will just put something on. Usually it's not something I have a terrible amount of investment in, so I don't have to pay too much attention. And so I popped in DVDs, when we still got DVDs, of a Comedy Central show called Review with Forrest McNeil, which I had no expectations for whatsoever. And then suddenly we get to the second episode, he's like addicted to cocaine. And the third episode, he has to eat 15 pancakes in one sitting. And suddenly I'm like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. And I had no expectations for it whatsoever. And so that is a delight to me. But at the same time, something like Pluribus is a delight, where it's like, okay, it's Vince Gilligan, and so you expect it's going to be good. But you put it on, and from the very first frame, there is so much confidence in what the images look like, how the story is specifically told, the acting choices, that you're like, oh, I'm in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing. And that is, even with the shows I really like, that is not often the case these days. So just seeing something told really, really well and with great confidence and craft excites me.
Yeah, I do have that moment of trepidation sometimes when I get to that thing where it's like, okay, the pedigree is good. You know, this is an Apple show by a really good creator, but, you know, like Better Call Saul, Breaking Bad, hard acts to follow. And I had that same experience, obviously, watching the first episode of Pluribus, where I'm like, okay, I feel like I'm in the hands of somebody who knows exactly what they're doing. It's funny, because my reaction to Pluribus is that I don't know if it is likely to be a breakout kind of hit crowd pleaser as Severance. For some reason, I feel like it's a little more, I don't know. I'm a little surprised that Severance is as big a hit as it is, quite frankly, because it's also kind of difficult. But this seems to be dealing with difficult issues. But, like, on another hand, and maybe you feel this way too, on the other hand, I don't care, right? Like, if I enjoy it, it's not my job to make sure that it's a hit or not. It's just my job to say, I think that this is a very impressive achievement. And it's a relief sometimes when you get something like that from somebody with a great pedigree and you're like, oh no, it actually is. They're doing a good job here.
It felt like, I'm sure it was aggravating that night, but it felt so good to hear that like Apple TV crashed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that says, oh, people are watching this. This is a hit right here. Because you never know. And it's not just that I wanted to succeed because it's good. I wanted to succeed because it's a wholly original idea.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if enough of these are hits, at a certain point, stubborn network executives and streaming executives will say, you know what? Maybe we should be more open to original ideas.
Apple has gotten, I mean, it's been quite a few years now since Apple hired Zach and Jamie away from Sony and put them in charge of cranking up a catalogless streaming service. And it's been fascinating to watch. And obviously, I'm interested in the TV side of it. And I'm also interested in it from the perspective of writing about Apple, that they have been finding their way in terms of like, what are the kinds of stories, what's the kind of content that they are more comfortable with. And they definitely the high budget sci-fi ish tinge show, they're not afraid of it. And it's, you know, and Severance is in there and Pluribus is in there and For All Mankind and Foundation. And there's a lot of that. They do a lot of international. They hired that executive from the BBC and ITV and put her in charge of European production. And you've gotten things out of that, like Slow Horses, for example. Like, it's really interesting to watch them kind of find places where they've got confidence. And then it feels like just go with it. Like Pluribus is a great example of, they had success with Severance. They've had some success with some other shows in that vein. And so they're like, well, we'll give Vince Gilligan a lot of money to make a show like that. And I love that, because I don't know who else would make that show. But Apple, it feels very Apple, which is something 5 years ago we didn't know what felt Apple TV like. But now it feels like an Apple TV show. And there's an actual kind of like concept of what an Apple TV show might be like.
No, that's exactly right. And I'd just like to see more of that. But yeah, to me, the only way in which ratings have ever mattered is this show doing well enough that I will get to see more of it?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Okay, as we get to the end of our time together, you mentioned that you're going to have to construct a best of the year list. I'm not asking you to give me the list now, but I am curious what you might consider for it, just to throw. We usually do like TV picks at the end here. Before I do that, I will give you my list, which is not a top 10 list, but I wrote down some shows that I like this year, and then I'll be curious what you say. The Pitt is absolutely on that list. Severance is on that list. Ludwig. Have you seen Ludwig?
I've seen a few episodes of Ludwig. I enjoy it.
I love it. It seems to be crafted for me. I love it. Hit me early in the year, and I love it. David Mitchell kind of is right in my happy place, so that was great. Adolescence, yeah. I would put on that list. I really loved Adolescence. And then also kicking around Pluribus, Slow Horses, Andor, The Studio, Hacks is still getting it done, I think, and The Diplomat, which is fun, even though it's definitely at a tier below. What are the shows that you're tracking right now?
I mean, you've listed a bunch of them right there. And I've not finalized my list yet, and I'm still figuring out when I'm going to publish it. And among the challenges I'm trying to reckon with right now is, like I said, Pluribus is probably going to be near the top. Could I put it at the top if I haven't seen the last two episodes at the time I'm going to publish it? And I remember there was a time where I was at Headfixer Up Rocks, where it was like I was debating what to do with Homeland and where to put it on my list for a given year, because I hadn't seen the last episode yet. I'm like, it's really good, but I don't know. And it was like, but down to that or New Girl, I think, for the number 10 spot. And ultimately, I decided, you know what? I will go with Homeland, because I have to publish this today, and I will, you know, expect that the Homeland finale will be great. And instead, it was the one where Brody didn't blow himself up. And in hindsight, I'm like, God damn it, I could have just put New Girl there.
Yeah, maybe you need to get to your Apple TV contact and say, look, you need to shake those last two episodes out for me so that I can put it at number one on my list. They probably, yeah. Vince Gilligan says no, is my guess. But
we will see. My yeah. hope is that I will at least get to see them in time to write about them in advance, because I believe the last episode is dropping either Christmas Day or the day after Christmas. And I, you know, even though that's not my holiday, I'm off and I don't really want to be writing a big essay, 3,000 words on Pluribus that day.
I don't know how tight they're going to be with Pluribus. I had the For All Mankind screeners and they got there toward the end. We had the last few withheld for a while, but they got there, but they may also just be full media blackout. We want to hold these because there's so much discussion of them. I don't know.
Yes.
Now we're in the weeds. Anything I didn't mention that you've got kind of like floating around is maybe on your list this year?
I mean, The Lowdown is definitely going to be really high up there.
Yes, yes. Thank you for your reviews of that. That has been delightful. I'm behind on The Lowdown a little bit, but it's one of those things, and I'm sure everybody tells you this, where I watch the episode and then I go find your story about it. So I'll back up. I have to scroll back on What's Alan Watching to get to the previous episode of The Lowdown.
That's the goal. That's the goal with doing it is, you know, if somebody comes to you after and said, I really enjoyed the episode, and then reading what you wrote made me enjoy it more. Like, that's, you know, if it was just a recap, you're not adding anything to the experience.
Exactly. No, it's those thoughts that you know, I have thoughts while I'm watching it, and then you point out things that I didn't notice, and then it's really nice. I'm also I'm tickled that the creator of Reservation Dogs has another great show. I'm also kind of amazed at how it is similar in a few ways, but also so different in other ways. I don't know. I'm very happy for him because it's a great show, and Reservation Dogs was so great that I love that this is the follow up to that.
Yeah, Sterling Harjo. Yeah, that's one where you ask how you choose stuff. If someone sends me screeners with the name Sterling Harjo on them,
instant
that moves right to the front of the queue
for sure. Yeah, well, Reservation Dogs, one of the great. That was once because I do a lot of podcasts, which means my wife watches a lot of TV without me, and that was one of the shows where she said, "Don't worry, I will watch it again with you." And I was like, "Wow, okay, let's watch it." And she was not wrong. It's just one of the best shows of the last decade for sure.
Yes, and one last one that I will mention. Usually these top 10 lists kind of trend more towards new stuff, but the most recent season of Always Sunny in Philadelphia was so good. It was one of their best in a really long time that I'm going to see if I can find room for it in my top 10.
Nice. Very nice. Well, Alan, I was, as everybody was, shocked and appalled about you leaving Rolling Stone, but I'm also happy that you had already set up What's Alan Watching, have been able to build up and continue to build that up as a subscription site. This is the plug at the end, I guess, where where we usually do it, which is I'm a subscriber. I think you do great work. And I think you're going to be fine, because I think you've got as somebody who's out here on my own, if you end up as a solo proprietor, I think you're going to do be successful and do great stuff. But it also really sucks that what happened. But I ended up in a better place. So I hope that happens for you, too. I'm very confident. I believe in you, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I appreciate your belief and your subscription, Jason. And, thank you.
and thank you for being on Downstream. Just trying to catch you while you're promoting your website, and we can get you in here. And I guess it's all good vibes until March 25th when my Giants host your Yankees on opening night, but that's my only baseball reference of the day. But for everybody out there, thank you for listening to this episode. You can consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This was a full-sized episode for everybody, but the only way to hear the complete version of our next episode and to hear ad-free episodes is to subscribe. Go to downstream.plus to subscribe to that and support the show. Of course, whatsalanwatching.com for Alan's website. And if you have a question, suggestion, comment, you can always leave that at downstreamfeedback.com. Love to your mothers. We love to hear from you. Until this is sort of a little extended break because it's Thanksgiving. We got our visit from Alan. We'll be back in December and we'll see you then. Alan, thank you again.
Thanks, Jason.
Bye, everybody.